Graduate credits available, landmark.edu. This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and here are some sounds from the top Granite State headlines.
We're actually dealing with a glorified lake effect event. Cold air passing over the relatively warm, moist waters of the Atlantic will pick up moisture, and the heaviest snowfalls will occur right along the immediate coast. We expect parts of the seacoast to see up to a foot. As you move inland, though, the snow won't be as heavy. Amounts will be about 5 to 10 inches across southern New Hampshire.
They're always looking at ways to plan to ensure that they can replace whatever energy source we're counting on a day-to-day basis. So when you have a new project coming in like Northern Pass, they have to go through that same process of planning, okay, if we're going to count on this new energy source for reliability purposes, how are we going to plan to replace it if something were to happen?
Well, I don't think it's a good option for Nashua. I think that, you know, 1 a.m. is soon enough. I don't see a benefit to an extra hour. This is an instance where I would feel comfortable saying no good can come of that.
I imagine that will get pushed through by bar and tavern owners or their associations who will work on some of the towns to put in a warrant article or for the selectmen or aldermen to change. But as of now, I haven't heard of any that has pushed for it.
They were pretty excited, but since it was actually broadcast live on national TV, a lot of my other family, like my relatives, cousins, grandparents, and aunts and uncles all got to see it, and they were all very happy. I think they were all more excited than I was.
I'm Richard Ager in for Laura Kanoy. Thanks for joining us.
From the top, that was meteorologist Rob Carolyn on the latest winter storm hitting New England, Northern Pass spokesman Mike Skelton on a new development with the hydropower project, Nashua Mayor Donnelly Lozo and Manchester State Rep Mark Warden taking opposite sides on a new law allowing towns to let bars stay open till 2 a.m., Andover native Nick Farrell on his family's reaction to the news that he'd qualified for ski jumping in the Olympics, and the late Richard Ager, longtime NHPTV reporter and occasional fill-in host for The Exchange, who died suddenly over the holidays. Again, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's get your thoughts, your questions, and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests for this week's Roundup are Norma Love, State House reporter for the Associated Press. Norma, welcome back and Happy New Year.
Good morning.
Also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And Gary, welcome back to you, too, and I hope you had a happy holiday.
Thank you.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And it's New Year, Dean. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Laura. Happy New Year.
Well, and all of you, I did want to start off. I know it seems obvious, but wow, Dean, how about that winter weather? I mean, just a few weeks into official winter, already a few big storms. This time, we've not just got the snow, but frigid temperatures. What are we seeing around the state because of this, Dean?
Well, you know, obviously, snowplow crews have been out now for well over 24 hours. You know, yesterday was one of those days where it just kind of snowed on and off all day. You know, the roads were reasonably passable, although slippery because it's so cold that the anti-slipping agents that they put on the roads either don't work or don't work as well. So, you know, personally around here in Concord, I was able to get out yesterday and get out and about and do some things. This morning, it's a nice, light, fluffy snow, so it was easy to move. But we already have fallen into kind of a remarkable pattern of, warm weather and rain followed by incredibly frigid temperatures and snowstorms. And I think it's going to cycle again within another storm on Sunday or Monday. So it's hard to believe. It's only the beginning of January. It feels like we've been in winter for several months, but we're just getting started.
Yeah, Gary, so town budgets for plowing may be already feeling taxed. What are you hearing and seeing?
I'm sure they are at this point. It started so early that I'm sure most towns and cities weren't counting on spending this kind of money this early in the season. Who knows? If it keeps going, there'll probably be some special sessions and few things like that going on to take care of the problems.
Yeah, and Chris Clement, the State Transportation Commissioner, Norma Love, has been making noises about, gee, lawmakers, if you cut my budget too much, I might not have enough snowplows out there for the state highways. Is this going to bolster Commissioner Clement's case?
Well, they have over $30 million they put aside or budget for snow removal in the winter. And, you know, over half of the trucks are actually contracted trucks. I think it's 400 and something trucks are contracted. and about 300 and something or state trucks. And most of the contracted trucks are in the south where you have the majority of the population, the majority of the roads to plow. But certainly I think it would be really one of the areas of his budget that people would look very skeptically at. It's sort of like cutting the cheerleaders of the football team. You can't cut certain things. Safety is involved. But maybe you wouldn't plow until you had an inch or 2 inches. Or instead of every 4 hours of trying to have a bare pavement, maybe it's every six. I mean, there would have to be some adjustments made.
All right. Well, again, it's cold, and I hope that there are no power outages. I hope that everybody stays warm, and we'll be obviously following this weather story through our newscasts and so forth here at NHPR. It is a new year, and as of January 1st, some brand new laws went into effect as of Wednesday. Which ones are standing out to you, Gary Reno?
Well, there are a couple that are very have caught a lot of attention. One of them is drive fast and don't look back or something like that. Anyway, there's up the speed limit to 70 in a section of 93 from just north of Canterbury up through to the Franconia Notch area.
And what was the thinking behind that? I remember that coming up last year.
Well, it's Manchester Representative Steve Valancourt's little child, and he's been pushing it for many, many years. His theory is that most people travel that fast or more anyway. He's notorious for saying he gets on 89 and drives 65 miles an hour and counts the cars that go by him, and almost all of them do. And so he's been trying this for years and years, and finally got through, didn't get vetoed, and state police and the safety agencies are not very happy about it.
Yeah, Norma Love, you interviewed Earl Sweeney, the state's assistant safety commissioner. He's not happy about this. Gary's right.
Well, I think Safety Commissioner Sweeney makes a good point. Look at the weather today. I mean, I'm a wimp when it comes to driving in snow. I grew up in California, and we used to have to put chains on our cars if we went into the mountains. You're going down the highway. It says 45 on the flashing signs, and people are just blowing by you, and I wave and say, see you in the ditch. I mean, it's that kind of thinking by state police that people don't always use common sense, and they will be going up this stretch of highway, which one of the thinking by the lawmakers in approving it was one of the safer stretches for that speed. They rejected a similar move for I-89, and I think Steve Valancourt is bringing it back along with something for 101. So he thinks that you should be able to go that speed because people are going that speed. Safety commissioners will say they'll go that speed, and they'll say, now I can add another 10 miles
right,
on
there's
top
a psychology,
of that.
Right, yeah, right, where you feel like you can go at least 5 miles above
nobody will
the
give
posted.
Me a ticket if I'm going. Now it's 70. Okay, now I can go 80.
Right, that's right. You know, the interesting thing to see will be what the average speed is, because there will be some people who will drive right at 70, but if you ride on the interstates now, the speed limit's 65, and I often see people going, you know, mid-70s, even up into the low 80s, and so you bump everything up, 10 or 15 miles an hour, and that stretch can get quite windy at times, and I know in the winter when that area sort of Canterbury up through Tilton, there are often a lot of rollovers and people sliding off the road, so, you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, and safety officials, Dean, are also not happy with another new law that went into effect as of January 1st. This is one, Dean, that says cities and towns can decide individually whether or not to let their bars stay open until 2 a.m. Right now, it's 1 a.m. Now, this is not to say that, you know, in blanket fashion, every bar across the state is going to stay open until 2 a.m. now, right, Dean. It's an individual town-by-town decision, but still state officials or safety officials are not happy about this.
Right, and the debate was whether or not to just push last call back to 2 a.m. from 1 a.m., and they came up with this compromise of letting the individual communities decide. You know, the plus side for businesses is it's an extra hour of business. The downside is for public safety officials, it means that an extra hour of drinking for people to potentially get in trouble behind the wheel and also dealing with other types of disturbances later on into the early morning hours. We heard in the open that there doesn't seem to be any communities pushing right at the moment for that. You might think of a place with a high concentration of establishments like a Portsmouth or Manchester or maybe even Nashua. That may happen. It may take some time to figure out which communities want it. But it is interesting. I've lived in other states where there's been a later last call, and there are always debates about whether or not to shorten it and maybe move it up towards midnight or 1 a.m. So, we'll see. It's obviously it's a community by community decision. But there are real safety concerns that were articulated back when this was debated last year.
And I think the police are also afraid that if one town says 2 a.m. and another town says 1 a.m., you'll get out at 1 a.m. and drive to the other town. Now you're on the road, you've been drinking.
All right. And hopefully not on that 70-mile-an-hour
stretch.
Stretch through Canterbury. All right. Two new laws that go into effect, among with a couple others, as of January 1st. If you want to join us on those topics and other news items that caught your attention over these last 2 weeks, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. All one word. Let's look at some of the new bills that will be coming up in this session, in the session that reopens next week. And Gary Reno, some reruns, right, from the first year of the session. Casinos, guns.
Oh, it is. It's just, it seems like the three big issues that we had last year was Medicaid expansion, casino gambling, and gas tax. And I think the three big issues this year, or three of the four big issues this year are going to be Medicaid expansion, casino gambling, gas tax, and the death penalty probably. So it is. It's like, sort of like deja vu all over again.
Or like Hollywood, right? You just keep recycling the movie.
Yeah.
So, Norma, how is the Medicaid expansion debate, for example, going to be different this time, or will it be different?
Well, I think it will be different. There already are discussions going on privately in the state Senate between some Democrats and Republicans. The Republicans in the Senate killed the efforts, both the one from the House as well as ones in the Senate in the special session. They just didn't feel that they were quite there. But I don't think they felt that they were not going to get there. The question was, can we get past the same issues that were holding us up before? How do we make the best use of private insurance? What is the timeline to get there? And will it be cost neutral? Because the way the system works with the federal government, it can't cost more for the federal government to do this. So if a private insurance plan is higher, how do you balance that out? Do you say, well, we're going to have savings in health outcomes? How do you balance that out? So there are some people who are working on this privately behind the scenes, and there's hope that they'll come out with something in January.
Okay, well, and on those other two subjects that you mentioned, Gary, casino gambling, gas tax, there will be some differences in the coming months, so we'll talk about those after a short break, and some of the new legislation that lawmakers will be looking at as well. All that plus your comments are coming up, 1-800-892-6477.
Good morning, you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Winter storm warning in effect until 10 o'clock this morning. The wind chill advisory in effect until 9 o'clock tomorrow. The forecast today, snow giving way to sunshine this afternoon. Still blustery and cold with highs near 10 below to 10 above. Blowing snow causing visibility issues. Storm is expected to move out of the area today, but the cold is staying put for now. Tonight, mostly clear in the evening and then becoming partly cloudy. Much colder with lows around 25 below in the south. And 32 in places like Coos County. Not as windy, but still downright bone-chilling. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Cooper Cargill Chant, attorneys invested in the people and organizations doing business throughout the region, offices in North Conway and Berlin. CooperCargillChant.com. This is member-supported New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week and last over the holidays. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Some of the news or headlines that caught your attention, we welcome your questions or comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Joining us for the roundup this week, Norma Love with the Associated Press, Gary Reno with the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. Just before the break, we were looking ahead to when lawmakers come back to Concord next week. And Gary Reno, you had said that last year the three big issues were Medicaid, casino gambling, and gas tax. And this year, three of the biggest issues will be Medicaid expansion, right, casino gambling, gas tax. Norma talked about Medicaid expansion and how that might be different. What about the other two, Gary? Will they be different this year, or will we be pretty much saying the same thing we said last year?
Well, the casino gambling bill, it there was a commission that worked over the fall into the summer and fall. And one of the big questions before was what kind of regulatory structure would this have? If we're going to do casino gambling, how are we going to oversee it? And so that's what this commission did. They came up with an overall regulatory structure with a super committee, if you will, to look at gambling oversight of gambling throughout the state, including the sweepstakes and the charitable gambling. But outside of that, it's very similar to what was proposed. One Southern New Hampshire casino with 1,500 slot machines, video slot machines, and about 150 table games.
You know, Gary, I have to ask you this because you've been covering the State House for a long time. So as you said, the casino debate, there's some changes around the margins, but not much. Why do they keep going back to this thing?
Because it looks like easy money. I mean, New Hampshire, somebody always used to say that, you know, New Hampshire is the philosophy of don't tax me, tax the man behind a tree. And that's what casino gambling is. It's a way of avoiding direct taxes on the citizens in New Hampshire. You're getting money from other people coming in. It's like the rooms and meals tax and things like that. They're really aimed at people coming into New Hampshire, not residents themselves.
And that's a debate that we'll have as the year goes on, because there's some issue that, you know, will it be locals and so forth. One last thing, Gary, and then I want to get Dean and Norma back into this as well. But the gas tax debate, from what I understand, will be different from last year.
It will. Senator Jim Rausch is proposing a gas tax that is tied to the consumer price index. And if you go through all the formulas and so on that he's proposing, it comes out to be about a 5 cent increase in the gas tax. Before last year, we had a...
Per year or...?
No, every 2 or 3 years, roughly, if that. But it's tied to the consumer price index, so it wouldn't go up or down that much, but it would be a little bit tied so that you don't lose, as he calls it, the buying power. Whereas last year we had a 15-cent increase that went down to 12 cents over 3 years. So that one is quite different and probably doesn't have a lot of legs either, but we'll see.
Dean Smith, I'd love your broad thoughts on, you know, the agenda facing lawmakers when they come back. It's not the budget part of the session, so they won't have this big, hairy budget monster, you know, staring at them. On the other hand, there are some broad themes that are emerging here.
Absolutely, and we know 2014 is a midterm election year, so we're seeing a preview of some of the arguments we're going to see from both parties throughout 2014, and I think it's going to be, to some extent, a debate about economic fairness, both locally and at the national level. So, you know, the economy has shown signs of life. I think growth in the third quarter was over 3% nationally, which is good. But there is this argument out there that the recovery is really only benefiting those at the top of the income scale. So you have this kind of group of issues at the state level, Medicaid expansion, as we've mentioned, a proposal to reestablish the minimum wage. The minimum wage in New Hampshire was eliminated in 2011. Now it was $7.25, which is the same as the federal minimum wage. So it was a symbolic elimination, but now there's a movement to reestablish it at $8.25 in New Hampshire and raise it up to $9 an hour in the following year. So there's going to be a debate mirroring the one at the national level about the minimum wage. So we got Medicaid, we got the minimum wage. We've had this debate nationally about whether or not to further extend unemployment benefits that came out of the stimulus package. They expired, I think, last week. And in New Hampshire, we're going to have a discussion about increasing unemployment benefits as well. So this agenda that we're going to see locally is all part of a larger national debate between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats arguing that that even though we're having a recovery, the recovery is not even, and in some sense there is economic inequalities that need to be addressed. And Republicans arguing that all of this stuff is just an example of governmental overreach, as typified by the problems with Obamacare. So I think there really is an interesting economic debate shaping up both locally and nationally.
Yeah, and we'll be taking a look at that minimum wage debate in more detail on Tuesday next week. So more on that then. Norma Love, one more sort of broad theme that I keep hearing about from the upcoming reconvening of the legislature is a $72 million surplus. Sounds like good news.
It would sound like good news, except they counted on $57 million of it when they wrote the budget. So it's not $72 million available. It's more like $15 million that was above what they had projected and drawn in and spent, in a sense. So, there'll be people who want that. It's sort of like your income tax refund. How many ways can I spend it? But they do have some draws on it. They recently settled a lawsuit, mental health lawsuit, and there'll be some spending needs from that. There are other draws where they'll have, who knows, maybe plowing costs more, maybe whatever parts of state government. It's just like your household budget. You have ups and downs. Just gasoline going up can cost a lot of money for fleets for the state, just like it does you and your household budget. Fixed costs. There can be unexpected costs. But there'll be people who will say, well, we didn't give as much to this program or this program, and we'd like to give them more money. And so we'll have that debate.
So this is also a strong push, Norma, to put whatever extra there is into the rainy day fund.
I think that the Senate Republicans, Chuck Morse, who is now Senate President, who was Finance Chairman, and his successor, Jeanne Forrester, both are making the argument that there's only $9 million in the state savings account, which is a puny amount of money, and that putting whatever we have that we can from this surplus into that account for a rainy day would be a very wise thing to do. And I think that without Republican support in the Senate to do anything else, probably that's what will happen.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number, join us, 1-800-892-6477. Here's a Facebook comment from Rebecca. She says, I'm from upstate New York, and every county has their own last calls. This can vary from 1 to 3 in the morning. Rebecca says, as college kids, we were near a county border and would drive to the next county and drink there. Not proud, she says, just saying these things will happen. Dean Spiliotis, that's what you mentioned earlier as well. The concern, or maybe it was you, Norma, the concern that, okay, if it's 1 o'clock in Nashua but 2 o'clock in Manchester, let's drink in Nashua and then get in our cars and drive to Manchester.
I think the point she's making is exactly what law enforcement is afraid of, that if you have this hopscotch effect around the state, people will do that, particularly young people who think they're invincible.
All right. Thanks for the Facebook comment, Rebecca. Again, it's NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can give us a call, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Speaking of Facebook, we got a lot of comments on our Facebook page about the possibility, and I want to put this in the right language, the possibility of charging canoers and kayakers a little bit of money to help pay for the costs of fish and game, which helps, you know, with anything from outdoor rescue to habitat upkeep and so forth. The legislature may examine the recommendations of a special commission on fish and game funding and all the outdoor work it does. Gary Reno, can you just clear this up for us? Because there's been some confusion about what this is really all about and whether the legislature is going to just look at this or set it aside and say thank you very much or what might happen.
Well, so-called boat tax, it was one of the recommendations in this commission that studied ways to better fund the Fish and Game Department. Fish and Game largely is funded through licenses for fishermen and hunters.
And yet there are a lot of other people who use the outdoors who don't fish and hunt.
Particularly hikers and people like that. And then you get into the rescues and who's going to pay for that. And so this commission was looking at ways to better fund the department. And this is one of the recommendations that came out of that commission. However, it sort of got somehow, I guess there was a story written that's saying this is what they're going to be considering. And no bill was ever filed. So it never really has come before the legislature. And it may probably never come before the legislature. So it got such bad publicity that you can be sure that it's not coming before the legislature now.
So this was a commission. They had some recommendations. This was one of the recommendations. And then people heard about it and the thing blew up.
Right. And then, so, I mean, it's up to the legislators on that commission if they want to put in legislation. And to date, no one has.
Okay. And I know, Dean and Norma, you want to jump in on this. I also want to share a couple comments, though, that we got on our Facebook page. And let me just say, I've got about 8 or 10 before me, and they're kind of split down the line, maybe a little bit more in favor of this thing. Jim says, as a hunter who no longer hunts but does kayak, I think it's fair. Hunters have long borne the overwhelming cost of outdoors management here in New Hampshire and for the most part have done so without complaining too loudly. but we need to look to all who enjoy the outdoors to do their part. DW also says, yes, it's a fair step to share this burden, says this kayaker slash canoer, non-motorized, recreation, anything user, non-hunter, i.e. outdoors freeloader. But then there are other folks, absolutely, who say, no, you know, charge a single annual fee per resident, then a fee per boat. Timothy says he has three kayaks and was planning to buy more for his grandchildren so they could all go kayaking together. If he buys three kayaks, that would be $60. And then Timothy says, if I went to kayak in Maine, I need to pay an equal amount to them. So maybe they do this in Maine already. I'd love your thoughts, Norma Levin. Dean Spiliotis, you too. Go ahead, Norma.
Well, I just want to point out that this is a long-standing problem with fishing game.
Absolutely.
And it's largely driven by the cost of rescuing hikers. Boaters, less so. Snowmobilers, off-highway, recreational vehicle drivers, hunters, fishermen, very minute percentage when you face the cost of what it is to rescue a hiker. And it's long been a grievance that for the hunters and the fishermen and the others who've paid the way that their habitat doesn't get the attention if all the money is going to the rescue fund. There's a bill coming before the House on Wednesday that would establish, allow them to establish what they call a hike safe card. They have this in other states. I think Colorado is one, which basically says if you're up, need rescuing and you're negligent, and we decide to pursue the cost of your rescue, we won't, if you have this hike safe card or if you have a hunting license or a fishing license or a snowmobile registration or off-highway recreational vehicle registration, basically trying to carve out and say, all right, you're already contributing to this in another way.
Oh, that's really interesting. So it's almost like an insurance card.
It's like a get-out-of-jail-free card. I don't know that it would excuse them from the costs that are now being borne by the state. The National Guard used to use its helicopters, which is about $5,000 an hour, and they call them training missions, and they wouldn't charge. But the national headquarters says they have to charge now. So if you're up in the whites and you need a helicopter rescue, it can get quite expensive. And I don't know that this would excuse those costs.
Okay, well, longstanding issue here in New Hampshire for sure. Dean, real
yeah,
quick to
sure.
you, and then we'll move on.
There are a few things that evoke greater passion at the state level than user fees. You know, this is a time-honored debate in state government. It's one way in which governors have been able to claim electorally that they haven't raised taxes, but they make up a lot of income through these user fees. And for me, it's always an interesting window into the kind of political culture of different organized groups and who is able to kind of block a user fee increase and who bears the brunt. But people are never happy about these kinds of issues. And as you've seen with Facebook, it evokes a lot of passion.
All right. Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Join us if you want to chime in on some of the top headlines that we've been looking at today on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And thanks to all those folks who commented on our Facebook page. So, Dean Spiliotis, here we are, 2014, very early in the year, but it is indeed a midterm election year. We've got some big races coming up this fall here in New Hampshire. They're still taking shape. I'd like to take just a quick look at them, starting with you, Dean, but hearing from everybody. The governor's race here in New Hampshire. Who is running on the Republican side against Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan? Who's in?
It's unclear at this point that there isn't going to be any serious challenge to Governor Hassan.
Any unserious challenge?
Right. I think George Lambert dropped out recently. He had talked about running. I think he dropped out for health reasons. Chuck Rolichek is the businessman is taking a pass as well. They don't seem to have any serious opposition. You know, we have a history in the state of reelecting first term governors, with the exception of Craig Benson. You know, it's only 2 years. She won by 12% and has had, by all accounts, a reasonably good initial run in terms of the budget being voted on, et cetera. So I think she's going to be difficult to defeat. I mean, she's somewhat protected from some of the national dynamics in a way that perhaps Senator Shaheen or Congresswoman Custer and Shea Porter might not be. So there just doesn't seem to be any serious challenge at this moment. And it's been interesting to me because it's been kind of a window into problems within the state GOP in terms of developing a bench of new potential future candidates.
Gary, have you ever seen this before, where here we are, January, an election year, and there's Nobody, as far I stand to be corrected, but there's nobody that I have heard of who's running against the governor.
Well, if you think back to John Lynch's first term, I mean, it was late in the game when Jim Colburn jumped in. I mean, it was toward the end of the legislative session, really, before he did. So it's not really that unusual. So, I mean, there are some names coming up. I mean, it's pushed to get John Stephen to run again. He's in a very successful consulting business right now, so I'm not sure.
He's run at least twice.
Well, he's
right?
run for governor once, and he's run for Congress
twice. That's right.
And there's a push to get him, but I mean, he's quite successful consulting business right now. I mean, it would be a real jump for him. There's a draft Andrew Hemingway, who's been involved in a number of political campaigns throughout the state. But there just really is nothing solid there for anybody.
Speaking of nothing solid, Norma, Scott Brown, the will he or won't he game, a speculation over whether former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown will run against Democrat Jeanne Shaheen. That continued over the holidays. Meanwhile, Jim Rubins, though, the former state senator who has been running a campaign very actively for months, he was honored recently. What happened?
Well, the union leader named him the Citizen of the Year, I think largely because what Rubens, former state senator, but he really made his name as the anti-casino gambling guy. He was sort of the go-to guy for the coalition. Wherever there was anything to do with gambling, he had his pile of papers that he would pull out and say, here are the studies why you don't want to do that. And
Very passionate, very energetic.
He says that he will be, step back from that if he is elected as to the U.S. Senate, but that will show his passion for issues, and he wants voters to take that as an example of who he is, not necessarily totally link it forever to casino gambling.
So not necessarily the issue, but look how successful I was on an issue that I really cared about.
Correct.
Although it does make you wonder, Dean, why he's not running for governor. I mean, this has been a big state issue. It's not really an issue for the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Well, he actually ran for governor once before, I believe, against Jeanne Shaheen,
yes.
and did not win. He really seems to be the only Republican actually running a campaign at this point. I know that Bob Smith has announced he's running. Karen Testament has said she's running, but as far as I can tell, they don't really seem to be building any credible campaign organizations. Maybe that'll change in the next couple of months. You know, it's been interesting that we talked about Senator Shaheen over the summer, and she seemed to be in pretty good shape. But we're seeing the impact of the national debate. Americans for Prosperity is running a $600,000 ad buy against her in the state, showing her saying the famous Obama quote about you can keep your health care plan. So she's kind of gotten pulled into the national debate along with a few others as well.
Okay, indeed. I got to cut you off there.
Sure.
We're going to go to a short break. More when we come back.
This is NHPR. You're listening to The Exchange. It's 9:39. Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from you, our members, and from Hypertherm, an associate-owned manufacturer of metal cutting equipment made in New Hampshire and sold worldwide. Hypertherm.com. This is member-supported New Hampshire Public Radio.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Health insurance coverage under the Affordable Care Act begins. The new mayor of New York City promises to tackle income inequality. Then Russia arrests dozens after suicide bombings just weeks ahead of the Winter Olympics. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we'd love to hear from you, your questions and comments about some of the headlines that caught your attention over the past week. We've been talking about some of them, including the legislature reconvening next week and some of the big bills that will come up in 2014. 1-800-892-6477 is our number, 1-800-892-6477. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Norma Love, Gary Reno, Dean Spiliotis, while we're talking about politics, an email came in earlier from Catherine in Milford, who says, regarding the recent news of a state legislator running down and killing or injuring several ducks, Catherine says, outrageous. They say you can tell a lot about a human being by the way he treats other living creatures. Enough said, Catherine says. Now, from what I understand, Norma, there's a little more to this state representative, David Campbell of Nashua, running over a couple ducks in that area than was first reported. But go ahead, Norma.
Well, David Campbell is a highly respected state legislator. I think that what happened from what I can glean from it, and I have not talked to David, but he generally is somebody whose word I would take. He came around a corner. There was a man who had gotten off a bus from the airport from Florida who was feeding crackers to these ducks. Now, there are ducks there. There's a pond there. There's a marsh across the way. They have problems there periodically with people hitting ducks because they come across the road.
Yeah, people have these sort of manicured lawns and ponds. They
right.
attract geese and ducks. And some and, people say, oh, isn't that nice? And some people say that's a nuisance.
Well, they put up signs at the hotel, please don't feed the ducks. Well, I don't know whether this man saw the sign or not, but David came around, and there are tight corners there, and hit some of the ducks in the road. Stopped, got out. But there's a difference of opinion between the stories interviewing the guy who was feeding the ducks as to what exactly happened after that. But Representative Campbell said that he came over and this man was very agitated, so he left and went into the hotel, apparently told them what had happened, and then left and went across to his office. Well, the man called the police, said this should be investigated, and the police say they're investigating. And David Campbell has since apologized for anything that he had done to upset anyone. And certainly he's not the kind of guy that I've ever known to be callous. So it's hard to know when you're not there. But I do know from that, having been at that hotel, that it's a problem with the ducks. And that's why they have the signs, don't feed the ducks. And I'm sure other people have hit the ducks. It just kind of snowballed in this particular instance.
All right. Well, Catherine, thanks a lot for the email. Two more quick political stories that I want to catch up on with all of you. And Gary Reno, the first congressional district, from what I've read, looks like yet another Frank Ginta, Carol Shea Porter rematch, but there are other candidates. Can you just give us a little sketch of that?
Well, Frank Ginta is going to have a primary challenger, former UNH dean, business school dean, Dan Innes. Who will make it interesting. It will be a very interesting primary because he's sort of more, if you will, old-school Republican, moderate, so to speak, not the new-school conservatives. So it will be a very interesting race. And he also happens to be gay, which will also make it be another little sort of twist on that will make it a rather interesting race. And it does probably look like it will be probably Frank Ginta versus Carol Shea Porter. And it should be a very interesting contest, although, I mean, to this point, Frank Ginta has been pretty quiet.
Yeah, I actually, reporters always get emails and news releases and so forth. And you do get more news releases from some than others at this point, but it's still new.
I wouldn't be surprised if Dan Innes didn't pull it off. Yeah. I think that he's certainly trying harder. He's organized. I think there is a split in the party. Between the Tea Party and the moderates, and there are undercurrents in the party trying to get someone like Dan Innes, who will be a candidate to represent them. It's not a district known for being a Tea Party district. That's sort of a misnomer in New Hampshire. There are these divergent groups that consider themselves quote-unquote Tea Partiers. But I think nationally there's a push towards the middle, and I think that could help him.
That's interesting, too, because in these midterm elections, it is sometimes a lot about motivation, right, Norma, and who can get their folks out as much as it is, the message or whatever.
And Frank Ginta and Carol Shea Porter is an old matchup, and Dan Innes would be a new matchup.
Love your thoughts, Dan.
Yeah, sure. The issue with Frank Ginta, in my view, has been traditionally, he has struggled a bit raising money. He also has not been as strong as he should be at kind of articulating a rationale for why he should have the seat, or in this case now, why he should have his seat back. So I'm kind of looking to see how he defines himself. The last time when he won the seat back in 2010, he sort of defined himself as kind of a Tea Party affiliated member of the House. He's sounding a little more kind of centrist and conciliatory this time, but he is, just by virtue of Mr. Innes being gay and married, that sets up up kind of an interesting discussion about the social agenda. I've said many times that, you know, I think that the party in the state kind of needs to sort of change its image a little bit to kind of keep with the sort of the larger changes in public opinion in the state. That would be a great way to do it. I know Mr. Innes has said he doesn't want to make that the issue, but if he is the nominee, it's going to be the issue nationally, whether he likes it or not. So he needs to get comfortable with that. You know, we can talk, if you want, we can talk about the second congressional district
please.
As well.
Sure.
You know, Annie Custer, you know, had a little bit of a rough ride, at least from a public relations perspective, this term. You know, her favorability is probably lower than it should be in that district, given that it is the more Democratic leaning of the two districts. You know, in terms of the Republican primary, right now we have Gary Lambert, who's a retired colonel, I believe he's an attorney as well, likely to face Marilinda Garcia, who is, I think, a four-term state representative from Salem. She was someone, she's in her early 30s. She was designated a rising star by the Republican National Committee. I had an opportunity to talk to Ms. Garcia at length a few weeks ago. She's really just kind of getting her organization off the ground, trying to build a campaign infrastructure. She's going to be an interesting person to watch. She seems to be highly motivated by the whole Obamacare debate, maybe kind of less schooled on foreign policy at the moment, but that'll come if she sets up a campaign infrastructure. So
well,
that could
foreign
be,
policy
could be
isn't
an interesting,
really something important for a member of Congress.
It certainly is for a member of Congress. But, you know, and again, I think that will come when she starts to focus on the race a little bit. But, you know, a lot of our discussion was about Obamacare and some of the health care issues in the state. So that could be an interesting primary. You know, Annie Custer is going to have some national support. That district tends to lean a little bit more in her favor. But it could potentially be a good race.
All right. Well, I want to ask all of you, just raise with all of you some really hard news for us in journalism. I think you all know what I'm going to say. On December 29th, longtime New Hampshire journalist Richard Ager of New Hampshire Public Television suddenly died at age 60. He'd been working at Wyoming Public TV for 2 years after severe cutbacks at NHPTV forced it to reduce its local news and information services. I just want to read a little bit from the NHPTV website and then get your thoughts. Richard produced live gavel-to-gavel coverage on the impeachment trial of State Supreme Court Chief Justice David Brock, dozens of presidential candidate profiles, in-depth reports on issues like gay marriage, medical marijuana, Northern Pass, and a moving documentary on the anniversary of the Challenger shuttle explosion. Richard's award-winning work was thoroughly researched, well-written. Many who knew him lauded his fairness, journalistic skill, and integrity, and I can only second that. Richard and I worked together on several political debates. He was the panelist. I was the moderator. Boy, Norma, I mean, you know this. He was terrific. He was passionate, sharp, determined. He also sat in this host's chair several times in the mid-2000s. He did a great job. This is a loss to us in journalism in New Hampshire.
I was trying to think the last time I saw Richard, and I think we were taping Outlook, which was one of the programs that got cut when the funding was reduced. We were over in the public, the library here in town in Concord. And Richard always had to have everything scripted very carefully. He was, you know, some hosts that we would work with would kind of, yeah, okay, we'll fly by through it. But Richard had it very scripted. Then I'll go to you, Norma. Then I'll go to you. Then I'll go to you. And he was just a professional and a very nice man.
Yeah, and super passionate. I just remember him really digging into the issues and like you said, having every bit of information that he absolutely needed before he went on the air. Gary, your remembrances?
Well, I think back to the impeachment trials. And I remember, you know, it was really kind of overload, information overload all the time. And those of us who were covering it used to, after things would get over, we'd stand around and talk about it. And Richard always was very insightful. He'd always find that one little thing that maybe he hadn't quite thought enough about, and he could say, and then he said that, and that was the real key to this. Yes, it was, Richard.
And everybody would go, he's right. Yeah. Well, and as you guys probably know, Richard, even though he worked at public TV for almost 20 years, he was from Canada. So he had that little Canadian accent.
About.
And one, I have to tell you this story because it just makes me laugh, even though I'm so sad because he was a wonderful man. He was filling in for me. I had a busy day. I had a lot of errands I had to do. So Richard filled in for me, and I was running errands around town in my car in Concord. And he was interviewing former Speaker of the House Donna Sitek on a book she had written. And every time he said, "My guest today is," which you have to say multiple times in an hour, he would say, "Speaker of the House, Donna Sitek. And I just remember driving around and just, you know, he was such a dear man, and it was just so funny to hear that little Canadian inflection there once every 10 or 15 minutes when he announced who his guest was. Go ahead, Dean.
Yes, like Norma, I got to know Richard quite well as a frequent guest on New Hampshire Outlook, and just a really nice guy, as you said, tremendously professional. He had this great manicured beard that gave him almost a Shakespearean bearing, and he had this sort of big personality. And I always found the conversations, even though, as Norma mentioned, he was sort of very well prepared and things were kind of laid out, tremendously engaging. Whenever I find myself just conversing with a host, rather than looking at my notes or paying attention to the road mapping, that for me, that's a sign of a great show. And I always felt on those Outlook shows that, you know, given the time constraints, we just really had a very substantive discussion. I was just very sad to hear of his passing. It was quite a shock.
Yeah, well, bless your heart, Richard. I want to do end on some happier news, and Dean, I'll turn to you on this. New Hampshire will, yes, be represented in the Winter Olympics in Sochi. The excitement is starting to build around this, Dean. It's not that far away. Granite State often sends a few folks, given the popularity of winter sports here. Who's going this year,
sure,
Dean?
Well, as we heard in the open, Nicholas Farrell of Andover, New Hampshire, he won the men's ski jumping competition out in Park City, Utah, which automatically qualified him for the Olympic team in Sochi. This is his first Olympics, so he'll be out there ski jumping for the U.S. And Casey Bellamy, who's a former UNH women's hockey All-American, has also been named to the Olympic hockey team, so she'll be skating for the U.S. So two that I know of so far that will be going over to Russia for the Olympics. I believe they start February 7th or thereabouts.
It'll be really fun to watch them. And I think I read, Dean, that the women's hockey team will be coached by former UNH standout Katie Stone, now the coach at Harvard University.
Harvard, right,
so there's
Harvard,
another
yes.
New Hampshire yes. connection there. So that's great. And good luck to all those Granite Staters over in Sochi. That's wonderful. Next week, boy, the Exchange has a full plate. We've got a panel of leading state lawmakers on Monday talking about some of the things we talked about this hour, folks. The new year at the State House. So we'll be looking at some of those bills that you folks mentioned. We're also going to take a full hour to look at the minimum wage debate. Later on in the week, we're going to dig into a new report on homelessness in the Granite State. Norma Love, probably pretty busy for you next week.
Oh,
what are you going to be tracking?
They're coming back Wednesday, so it usually takes a day or two to get ready. And the House in particular is going to be dealing with some vetoes. They're going to pretend like it's 2013 for a little while. And then do the vetoes. If they pass any, they'll go to the Senate.
No, wait, can you back up and explain that, Norma? Because I read something about that. Before they jump into 2014, they have to, at least an hour or two, pretend it's 2013.
They pretend like it's 2013. What they are is basically still in recess from last year.
I
and
see.
They'll stay in recess. They'll come out of recess. The House has three veto. Governor Hassan did not veto any Senate bills. But if the House should override any, they would go to the Senate. So the Senate has to pretend like it's in 2013, at least until the House deals with the vetoes. Once that's over, they adjourn, then they reconvene in 2014.
How long does that take?
Depends on how long it takes to debate the vetoes.
Sure.
It could be anywhere from an hour to several hours. But as soon as they come into session, the Senate is typically in its first day doesn't do any of the bills that it kept over the summer and fall. They call them re-referred or retained bills. The House, on the other hand, has dozens and dozens of them. And they've broken their calendar up into three sections, and they'll deal with, like that hike safe would be one bill. They'll deal with a number of bills, and if they're whizzing along, they'll go into section two. If not, they'll come back the following Wednesday and start again.
Wow, so that's what you'll be tracking, this whole opening ceremonies, or reopening ceremonies, if we could put it that way.
Reopening ceremonies.
Gary, how about you?
Well, I'll be doing much the same. It'll be interesting because a lot of these bills that they retained were controversial, and when they're coming back, a lot of them are sort of watered down a little bit, but some of them are still going to create an awful lot of debate.
When you say retained, you mean
leftover from last time, retained or re-referred. The Senate re-refers bills. The House retains bills. But the House certainly has a lot of bills, including the financial resources bill for the investors. That's going to be very
controversial. The FRM scandal. There's a bill to sort of compensate some of those folks.
$5 million fund and some people are don't really like it at all, saying we're setting a very bad precedent. And others say, well, we also, the state was at fault to a certain extent for not overseeing it the way it should. So that'll be another – that's one of the bills that will be coming up in the first month in the House. That'll certainly be a very controversial bill.
Yeah. How about you, Dean? What are you going to be watching next week?
Well, certainly watching the kickoff of the legislative session, although it's going to be in fine hands with Gary and Norma, but I'll be watching as well. You know, I'm interested to kind of get a feel for sort of the political dynamic this time around. Is it going to be any different, or is it going to feel a lot like what we felt last session on things like casino gambling and the gas tax and Medicaid expansion? And then, you know, it is 2014. It's time to lock in on those big congressional races, particularly how some of the primaries shape up in the Republican Party in this instance. So, you know, just seeing if there's any action on those as well in the next few weeks.
The first and second congressional districts do seem to be nationally ranked as up for grabs. Is that what you're reading, Dean?
Yeah, I think that's generally the case. Carol Shea Porter, who's, you know, been down before, it seems to be resilient. Annie Custer, this is going to be her first attempt at re-election, so that's going to be a challenge. You know, the Jean Shaheen race, it's kind of mixed. I've seen some predictions that she's have a difficult race. Others who say it's much ado about nothing that she's likely to be reelected, but there are going to be some interesting, I think, exciting races. And again, we're going to see a huge influx of national interest in money, particularly in that Senate race.
All right, so some of that national money that we saw in 2012, Dean?
Absolutely, even more probably.
Really?
Well, certainly at the state level. I think, you know, you're already seeing this. Almost, you know, $600,000 buy on Jean Shaheen for Americans' Prosperity. They're spending $2.5 million nationally just to go after three senators. And I think we'll see that in the congressional, in the House races as well, if there's a determination by these groups that those seats are, in fact, vulnerable.
Okay. All of you, thank you very much for being here. Thanks for all your help last year. We'll see you on another roundup soon, I'm sure. Norma Love, thank you very much for being here.
Nice to be here, Laura.
Norma Love, State House reporter for the Associated Press. Gary Reno, thank you.
You're welcome.
Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Dean Spiliotis, I'll see you next week. Thanks
sure
for your
thing.
Time.
Thanks, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
What's the latest in the legislature? How is the healthcare debate evolving? Who fired the latest shot in the presidential race? For answers to these and any other questions you might have, turn to The Exchange, weekday mornings at 9. We'll take your calls and emails as we dig into the topic of the day. I'm Laura Kanoy, inviting you to join me with your questions and comments on The Exchange, weekdays at 9 a.m. here on NHPR.
Good morning, it's 9:59. It's Diane Rehm Show coming up next on New Hampshire Public Radio. The support comes from you, our members, and from Bedford Falls Assisted Living and Memory Care Community, and a team of dedicated caregivers working with families to improve the quality of aging. BedfordFallsAssistedLiving.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama and Congress begin the new year with their lowest approval ratings ever. That news highlights the challenges both parties face as Congress returns to finalize a budget for the fiscal year. The Supreme Court deals the Obama administration and